a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to get a glimpse into the life of the honeybee. Our guest is a beekeeper. Susan Brackney is also a nature writer and a master gardener. She makes her home in Bloomington, Indiana. She's written, believe me, a delightful book about bees. The title, Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. The bee in the title, Plan B, is spelled B-E-E. But bees were literally Plan B for our guest, Susan Brackney. More on that in just a bit. Meanwhile, let me give you an idea of what you'll find within the covers of Plan B. The book includes chapters on the bee family tree, life in the hive, including the sex lives of queens, bee anatomy, threats to honeybees, a look at beekeeping, gardening tips to attract honeybees, and honey recipes. In addition to Plan B, Susan Brackney is the author of The Insatiable Gardener's Guide, The Lost Soul Companion, and The Not-So-Lost Soul Companion. You'll find her online at www.planbbook.com. And again, Plan B is spelled B-E-E. Susan, how are you? Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm well. Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. What a delightful book you've written.
Oh, thank you.
Bees were Plan B. What was Plan A?
I really wanted chicken. and I bought a little house in the country. And not long after that, it was suddenly in the city. So they put the kibosh on my chicken plan.
Yeah. So then how did bees become Plan B?
Well, I've always been a big gardener, and I thought that honeybees would probably make things even better in my garden. And I knew that they were running out of places to live. I'd heard that they were sort of in dire straits. And so I thought, well, maybe I could do honeybees. And I took a quick little night class on it and realized that I need all kinds of expensive equipment. And, you know, I was just sort of thinking, well, maybe this won't work after all. But I mentioned to a friend that I was sort of interested in this and then sort of forgot about it. And long time after that, I got a phone call. Turns out this fella had found everything I would need at a garage sale. A man had just married a woman, a beekeeper had just married a woman who was allergic to bees. And so he was giving up beekeeping for her. And I got all his stuff in the process. My friend just said, you can have it. All I want in return is honey for life. So that's what we've been doing.
Yeah. So how long have you been at it now?
Since 2003.
Yeah. Okay. You know, beekeeping is a big commitment. What kind of a commitment is required?
Well, it sort of depends on the time of year as to how busy you are. During the height of the nectar flow, when lots and lots of flowers are in bloom, you look at your hive, I look at mine anyway, at least once a week, just to make sure that they all have enough room to store the nectar that they're bringing in and they don't feel overcrowded. That's really important. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sometimes I take honey off a little in the spring or a little in the fall. And in the winter, you don't have to do quite as much, although I do traipse out into the snow and feed mine nectar that I make on the stove, just because I really like to pamper my bees.
Yeah. Well, how do bees, if they were left on their own, how do they make it through the winter?
Well, they don't hibernate. The queen stays in the center of a, they call it a cluster. It's like a big ball made out of bees. And the bees all flex their wing muscles without actually flapping their wings. And that generates an incredible amount of heat. Actually, it's pretty tropical in the center of that little ball. It's like 90 degrees.
Wow.
So the queen never even realizes that it's yucky outside and freezing cold. But the bees on the outside of the ball, eventually they die off, and the ball gets smaller and smaller and smaller as that happens. And hopefully by the time spring rolls around, you still have an intact queen and enough population to get things going again.
Yeah.
So it's kind of touch and go.
Yeah. It's interesting to realize now, I've learned so much reading this book, that bees also in the summertime, they provide their own air conditioning.
They do. They'll actually, a line of them will stand at the entrance of the hive and flap their wings. And at the top of the hive, other bees will flap their wings, and it almost makes a current of air draw through to sort of help evaporate moisture in the nectar that they're ripening into honey, and also to just cool things off a little bit. Because you open up one of those hives to inspect, and you're just hit with this heat wave. It's just really remarkable.
Hmm. Americans consume about 1.31 pounds of honey a year, 1 1/3 pounds of honey a year, roughly.
Yep.
For each of us, that's so much work for the bees. Tell us what's involved in producing a teaspoon of honey.
Well, that's the equivalent of the life's work of 12 bees. It takes quite a lot of effort just to make one little teaspoon. And what they do is they'll go out and go from flower to flower and sip up the nectar and store it in their honey stomach. And when that gets full, they'll fly back to the hive and transfer their load either directly into a empty cell or to one of their other sisters waiting to take their load and pass it on into the wherever it's going to get stored. And interestingly, depending on what kind of flower they're working on, they'll store that nectar all together in the same portion of honeycomb. So if you want to, you can actually, if lavender is in bloom, say, and that's what they're working on, you could ostensibly save that honey and render that, and you would have the lavender variety of honey. There are beekeepers who have all kinds of artisanal varietal honeys, but I don't separate mine out. I just mix it all up, and it's just wildflower, and it's still really good.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how much honey do you harvest through a season?
Well, I don't take very much at all.
Yeah.
I just take enough to bribe the neighbors and, you know, give as gifts and, of course, for my own household use. And I always make sure they have about 60 pounds. That's what they need in order to get through the winter.
Yeah. You describe beekeeping as becoming a lost art. How many beekeepers are there today?
Oh, gosh. Well, there were like 200,000, I want to say in the 50s. There are certainly many fewer now. Colony collapse disorder has been a problem for a lot of the commercial beekeepers, but varroa mites and tracheal mites, two kinds of parasites, were really, really a problem in the 1980s and 90s. So for a lot of different reasons, we've been losing beekeepers along the way. Some got discouraged when they, you know, the mites were really so much trouble and we were having trouble getting a handle on it. a lot of the beekeepers were just older people who didn't have anyone young around them who would be interested in learning the craft. So some of it's died out as a result. And then there are beekeepers out on the West Coast who maybe were hobbyists but now are getting out of it because the Africanized bee has really colonized there, and they're much more aggressive and not quite as fun to work with. So there's lots of different reasons why there aren't as many beekeepers as there used to be.
Yeah.
In fact, it used to be that it was just very common. Just about everyone would have a hive of bees. That's how you got your honey.
Yeah. The Africanized bees, apparently you can keep them, although, as you said, they're not quite as much fun.
Yeah.
And at the end of the first chapter in Plan B, you tell readers you met a fellow who is a beekeeper who tends hives of Africanized bees. What led him to make that choice?
Well, you know, where he was living, the Africanized bee had really infiltrated, and, you know, there wasn't much else you could keep in that area. If you did order a package of bees from down south somewhere, it wouldn't be long before the queen mated with the feral bees in the area, which were, by and large, Africanized. So even if you tried to not have them, eventually you would have them. And that was the case with this man. Part of his business was coming and taking swarms of Africanized bees out of places where they had become a problem. And, you know, they make honey just like a regular European bee.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they're very hardy. They can withstand all kinds of conditions. They can't overwinter up here in Indiana, where I am, just yet. But I suspect that one of these days they might.
Then what will you do?
I will wear more protection. You know, I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
I might be so unnerved that I just do go back to chickens, but let's hope not.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed. How many species of honeybee are there?
Well, do you mean Apis mellifera in particular?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Well, there are quite a number. There are Italians and Carniolans, and even when you say Africanized bees, there are many, many, many different varieties of honeybee in the continent of Africa. And the Africanized bees that we know of, that's actually just one particular Apis mellifera scutellata. So there are other bees in Africa that don't have those, you know, quite the same aggressive traits. And interestingly, all these different bees from all over the world have all kinds of distinctive, almost like personalities and colorations. The Italians, for instance, are a beautiful gold bee, and they're pretty docile. They're good for beginners, and that goes for the Carniolans as well. But my bees out here are Russian bees. They handle the cold winters really well. And let's see, there's some German bees that are very dark and not quite as mild-mannered, but they all have their different benefits, I guess you could say, and it's kind of fun to work with all the different kinds.
Yeah. Let's go back to colony collapse disorder. What's the latest on this disorder?
Well, the very latest, I guess you could say the good news is that enough folks are paying attention now that there is research money that's being, you know, filtered into the right hands so that folks can sort of try to get a handle on this. I know some researchers in Spain think that it might be caused in part by Nosema, which is another pathogen that honeybees have had to deal with for quite some time. Most researchers think that it's a combination of things that are all sort of working in synergy to lessen the honeybee's defenses overall. So, you know, some say that it's pesticides. Some folks say that it's the pollination circuit that these bees have to travel from Florida to Texas, all the way up the West Coast and all the way back down again. That's a lot of wear and tear if you're a honeybee. Mm. Plus, you're exposed to all those different pathogens and parasites along the way. There could be a number of things working together to cause this problem.
There's a researcher by the name of Jerry Bramenschenk who is listening to hives for some clues. What's he listening for?
Oh, yeah. His work is fascinating. He has these tiny, tiny microphones that he drops in, and it's like each hive... Well, I should back up. He exposes different hives to, for instance, different chemicals and records the buzzing that they make when they are exposed. And believe it or not, the buzzing will actually change. And from one hive to the next, that change is identical. So he can actually do the recordings, feed those sound signatures into a computer which can then analyze them. And if you hear a certain signature, he can actually point to that and say, those bees have been exposed to this chemical or that pathogen. So it's possible that if he records a sound signature for honeybees that have a problem with colony collapse disorder, you might be able to listen to a hive of bees and know that they're affected in that way.
Hmm. Are we also going to learn about bee communication through this work?
Well, there's so much to know.
Yeah.
And I don't think that researchers still know everything that there is to know about how honeybees communicate with one another. I know just fairly recently, researchers determined that honeybees are kind of democratic when they've swarmed, and the different scout bees are trying to decide where should they locate next. And they'll fly out and check things out and come back and report to the swarm of bees that's hanging around in some tree waiting for their marching orders. And they'll actually compare these different areas and sort of take a vote. And once enough of the bees have decided, yeah, let's head out, they go to that particular winning location.
Fascinating. Really interesting. Our guest this afternoon is Susan Brackney. She's a nature writer and a master gardener. She's also a beekeeper and the author of Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. The bee in the title Plan B is spelled B-E-E, but bees were literally Plan B for our guest. She wanted to keep chickens. That was Plan A, but that didn't pan out. So she went with the bees. Plan B is the title of our guest's book this afternoon, Susan Brackney. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener on the toll-free line. Good afternoon, line four, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question and a comment.
Okay.
I'm interested in becoming a beekeeper. How do I do that? And my comment is, last year we had an outside water dish for the animals, and it was very deep blue. Every day I would wake up, and that water dish would be semi-full of bees, either dead and floating or around the rim. Somehow they were attracted to that deep blue hole, and I wonder if this is an indication of the ozone hole is making the bees blind and unable to see.
Okay, well, let's see. Let's go with the water dish part of that question first. I think it's important to note that honeybees do need water just like everybody else, and sometimes if there's a hive around and they don't have access to water nearby, they'll go out in search of it, and they might end up in your swimming pool or your bird bath or, in this case, the deep blue water dish. I actually put little saucers of water outside around here for my bees, and I put rocks or marbles or seashells, you know, anything that they can stand on when they drink, I put those in there so they don't drown, exactly like you saw. As for the color and everything, I know honeybees can see ultraviolet radiation, and they can see things a lot differently than we do. So it's hard to tell what they were seeing when they were attracted. I'm guessing that they just were attracted to the water. And, yeah, they just drown because it's too deep for them and nothing to really hang on to. As far as becoming a beekeeper, I think that you would mainly, to start, need a good suit, or at least long sleeves and long pants and some gloves that go up to your elbows, and obviously a hat and a veil. And you would also need a bee smoker and obviously a hive and some honeybees. And the honeybees themselves, you actually order by the pound through the U.S. mail, unless you know of a beekeeper nearby who would, you know, provide you with honeybees. One of my very favorite resources is Bee Culture Magazine, and I always recommend that for beginners. They have a website online, and they have a whole bunch of their articles archived that you can go check out for free. And some of them are very complicated, but there are a lot that are just good for beginners. So that's what I would point you in the direction of.
Does the listener want to follow up?
No, I okay. I will get on the internet and go to the library and check those things out.
And also check out our guest's website, because you can see her in action there.
Yeah, actually, you can even see my honeybees in action. We have a live streaming beehive cam there.
Beecam.
Yeah. And I love watching it. When I'm not actually outside looking at them, I'm probably in my office looking at them on my computer. So.
And Susan's website is www.planbeebook.com. And bee, again, is spelled B-E-E. Other telephone calls are welcome for our guest, Susan Brackney, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. So should we avoid a brilliant blue bird bath for the backyard?
Oh, I wouldn't.
Yeah, okay.
No, I wouldn't. And generally, when honeybees are out foraging for nectar or pollen or water, they're not going to display a lot of defensive behavior. They're just going about their business. So as long as you...
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't be afraid of them.
Yeah, as long as you leave them be, they'll leave you be.
And let's go ahead and take another call now. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. First of all, I love your title. I think that's very clever. There's something that I think is overlooked in terms of the advantages of honey as opposed to sugar. Sometimes it's marketed as health and anti-allergy and all that, and that may be true. But to make sugar takes a tremendous amount of energy to boil that thin liquid from the sugar cane down into crystalline sugar. So in my way of thinking, it's kind of doubly an environmental issue.
That's actually very astute. I often say that honey is the sweetener with the lower carbon footprint, especially if you buy yours from a local supplier, or if you are a beekeeper yourself. It's certainly there are folks who say, like those with allergies, they swear by eating their own local honey because you know, it may contain some bits of pollen from the local flora, and thereby inoculate a person, so to speak, or at least strengthen their defenses so that they don't have as serious an allergic reaction to, you know, the pollen in their area. I don't know whether or not that's necessarily true, but anecdotally, certainly, I've had lots of folks come up and suggest that to me. There are other folks who say that honey is easier to digest than sugar because, in a way, the honeybees have added some of their own enzymes, which do help break it down a little bit. But the difference between that little extra digestive aid and regular sugar isn't that big for most folks.
Does a listener want to follow up?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. And Susan, tell us about the honey that we'll find in the supermarket. Maybe we would be wise to look carefully at the label.
Oh, yes, indeed. If you go to the market and you see honey that says honey blend on it, you might think, oh, this is a mixture of, you know, maybe this is some clover honey mixed with some wildflower honey, you know, mixed with tupelo or something like that. But actually, that's not the case. It can mean this honey has been cut with corn syrup or high fructose corn syrup, some other kind of thinner, just to make it go farther, which I found kind of disturbing, you know?
Yeah. So this is good news for the folks who have apiaries and selling locally.
Indeed. And yeah. The other thing I guess I should mention about the honey that you find in the big grocery store, you may notice that it tastes uniformly the same and looks uniformly the same. That's because large honey packagers pasteurize and heat process their honey. They shoot it through these high-pressure machines that take out any crystals and air bubbles and bits of pollen, any kind of in any kind of impurity that might cause it to look in some way thick or crystallized or not perfect, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, they kill off a lot of the more subtle, complex flavor. You do lose a whole lot in that process, and you would never know it if that's the only kind of honey you ever eat. Then it always looks just like that and always tastes just like that. But if you try honey from around you, from different beekeepers and different locations and different times of the year, depending on the floral nectar sources, you'd be amazed at the range and complexity of flavors. There are folks who have compared tasting varietal honeys to tasting wines because they can be surprisingly complex.
Hmm. Susan Brackney, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. They are the honeybees. Questions, comments are invited. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So how is a hive organized, and how many worker bees and drones are there within a hive?
Well, that depends on what time of year it is. People don't necessarily know this, but most bees in the hive are female. The queen, there's one queen per hive, obviously. She's the life of the place. And the worker bees are all female. And then the drones are the males, and they exist solely to mate with the queen. And otherwise, they don't do a lot. So depending on what time of year it is, in the spring, there are many drones because that's going to be the time of year when queens need to mate. And during the summer months, the numbers of drones may wind down a little bit. And by fall, the honeybees actually kick the drones out, and they freeze to death outside because they aren't needed and they're a drain on the hive over the winter. And so when the bees are ready for more males, they just make them in the spring.
Mm. On the one hand, the drones have it pretty easy until autumn, if they've lasted that long. On the other hand, once their purpose is served, they're goners.
It's true. The ones that actually do mate with a queen pretty much instantly die. And it's kind of graphic, so I might just leave that out. You don't want to know. Yeah, and the ones that don't mate with the queen, and, you know, if it's early in the summer, you're not going to get turned out anytime soon, then your life's pretty good. You can eat anything you want. You can go into any hive you want without being accosted by guard bees. You're basically welcome anywhere, which is not the case for a worker bee. She can't just go any old place in a different strange hive where she doesn't belong. But a drone can. So his life is free and easy as long as he didn't actually mate with a queen,
mm-hmm.
and as long as it's not too close to fall. So that'd be okay. That'd be good work if you could get it.
How many drones will a queen mate with at a particular mating point?
Several. Okay. And, one after the next. And after her maiden flight is over, she returns to the hive, and she has all the sperm that she's going to need. She saves that up, and she basically lays eggs for the rest of her life, and that's all she does. She doesn't leave the hive. Once a queen has mated, for some reason, she can't stand light, and she's drawn to darkness. So she's not going to want to go back out into the light anyway.
Yeah. Well, there's part of the story about bees and the birds and the bees.
Yes.
Let's take another call. A listener in Mattoon on line 4. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I wondered, how long does honey keep?
Oh, yeah. You know what? It keeps pretty much indefinitely. It doesn't have bacteria. They're not able to live in it. The only thing that it does have sometimes, and this is rare, but it can have Clostridium botulinum spores in it. If you've ever heard that you shouldn't give babies or toddlers, you know, under about 1 year of age, honey, that's because these spores might be present, and folks that age can't handle those spores. They don't have the defenses built up yet. But after about 1 year of age, they can safely eat honey. And, honey keeps. Now, if you have some honey that has gone kind of solid or crystallized on you, it's really easy to get that back into a more liquid state. You can either put it in your microwave on low for just a very, very short amount of time. You don't want to scorch or carbonize your honey. It won't be very tasty after that. Or you can put it in a hot water bath for a few, maybe a couple minutes on your stove. And same story, don't let it get too hot. But the crystallized honey will go back into a more liquid form. But those crystals are perfectly natural.
Good. Well, I had this. It came from clover honey from a beekeeper.
Oh, okay.
And I've had it quite a while, and I thought, oh, I've got to get that out. But I heard that it never goes bad, but I wanted to check.
Yeah, no, it doesn't go bad. They have found honey from, I think they found some in an Egyptian tomb. They found this canister that had honey in it, and they tried it, and it was, you know, tasted fine. It's pretty crazy, but honey is quite a perfect food.
Boy, it must be. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Other calls are invited for our guest, Susan Brackney. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Talking about the honeybee. this afternoon. So the ancient Egyptians used honey for medicinal purposes. What did they use it for?
Well, they used it in preserving corpses, for one thing. It does have antibacterial properties. I don't know whether they understood that or not, but they knew that it was great at preserving things. Sometimes they even stored organs in it in some cases. So they revered it. A lot of folks have linked the honeybee with God and religion because beeswax candles, you know, were so integral for a lot of religious services. And, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the products that we get from bees. You mentioned beeswax and honey, of course, but then there's mead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's found in soaps. And what else?
Well, let's see. There's pollen. A lot of folks will eat that, and they ascribe a lot of benefits to it, although I'm not necessarily 100% on whether or not those are really true. There haven't necessarily been double-blind scientific studies to really confirm all the different things they say about pollen. And that would go for royal jelly, too. You might see that it's in all kinds of creams and potions nowadays because it's said to have anti-aging properties. And again, well, I'm not quite sure that that's really been proven anywhere. As far as I can tell, royal jelly is really just best left for the bees, you know?
What is royal jelly like, and how does it differ from honey?
Well, it's this white, creamy, kind of liquidy substance that I think if most people knew where it comes from, they might be kind of creeped out. When a young bee is of the right age, she can make royal jelly in a gland in her head. And royal jelly is what's fed to larval bees to produce queens. So that's what it's for. And interestingly, depending on what larval bees eat, it will flip certain genetic switches to either make a queen or a drone or a worker.
How does the queen get to be the queen? Because the workers will be feeding royal jelly to some bees, and then, well, they've got a number of potential queens.
Yeah, they'll do this if their own queen has been injured, or she's died, or maybe she's just not quite up to snuff, you know, and they've decided we're going to replace her because we're not that happy with her performance. Then they would choose a number of larval bees that were at just the right stage in their lives that they would begin feeding them nothing but royal jelly to create a queen, a new queen. And you might have 10 to 12 of those in one hive. And as they make their way out of their cells, they fight to the death. And basically, the last queen standing is going to be their new leader. And at that point, once they're certain that they, you know, if there was a queen that they were superseding, they would then dispatch her and replace her with this new one.
How does the queen bee's appearance differ from the drone and the worker bee?
Well, she's much bigger, and her abdomen is longer and slender. And in my hive, she is a lighter, like a caramel-colored bee, and she's not fuzzy like honeybees are. She's just kind of smooth and shiny, and I think she's gorgeous.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Susan Brackney is our guest this afternoon. She's a beekeeper. She's a nature writer. Her latest book, Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll free 800-222-9455. And Plan B, the title is Plan and then B, B-E-E. But bees were literally Plan B for Susan. She had her hopes set on her plan A, which was getting chickens, and that didn't turn out. So she went with bees, and she's been keeping bees now since 2003. Well, tell us about your garden and what you've planted with your bees in mind.
Sure. Well, when I garden for my bees, with my bees in mind, and really anyone can do this, essentially what you want to do is always have something in bloom so that they never run out of food. So from the very early spring, I try to have snowdrops and crocus and other really early blooming bulbs, which I never used to be interested in bulbs, but now that I know that I need to fill in those gaps with as much nectar and pollen as I can, they've become pretty valuable to me. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, I have some natives like Joe Pye weed that honeybees love, and sunflowers and fennel and basically lots of flowers with tight clustered flower heads like yarrow, Monarda, that's also known as bee balm. Mm-hmm. They love that stuff. And if I have goldenrod or ironweed, I might have pulled that at one time and cursed it as a terrible couple of weeds, but now I really value them.
Yeah.
Because they're great pollen sources.
What is it in the Monarda that they love?
Lots of nectar.
Lots of nectar, okay.
Lots of nectar.
Okay, because each one of those little tiny flowers on the head, there's all kinds of, it's a blossom with many blossoms.
Yeah, I guess in a way, it's more bang for their buck, you know?
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Centralia on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Is there an affinity between women named Sue and beekeeping? Yeah, you know, I'm sure you know of Sue Hubbell's book from, 30 years ago, A Country Year?
Yes.
And I haven't read your book, but I certainly read and enjoyed her book. And I'll look forward to finding yours and reading it also.
Oh, well, thank you. And then, you know, there's Sue Monk Kid, too. There's, there's probably lots of Sues and bees.
The Secret Life of Bees.
That's right.
Yeah. You also devote some ink and paper to bees and literature and language. That's fascinating as well.
Yeah, when you start to look around, you realize that they're an important part of our culture and they're in our everyday speech. You know, busy as a bee, we have this idea of them that they're really industrious and we hold them up to a high standard. Yeah, definitely. They've made their way into Shakespeare and early American poetry, and they're all over the place. The more you look, the more you find them.
Yeah. The bee's knees.
Yeah, the bee's knees, exactly. Folks aren't quite sure where that one originated.
Yeah.
They think maybe a flapper said it, but nobody's really sure. I tried to get that one down for sure, but I wasn't able to really verify.
Yeah. And the bard?
Yes. The Be Loud Glade. That's a great line of poetry. It's escaping me right at this moment. Who wrote that? Maybe somebody will call in and say.
Okay, well, let's take another call. A listener on line 1 in Champaign County. Hi.
Well, Hi. I was worried I wouldn't get in, but I have Russians, and they work hard. They work early in the season, and they look for all sorts of sources of pollen. They're out in the pussy willow as probably one of the earliest things. But my sustaining crop is dandelions.
Mm-hmm.
They really love the dandelions. I hate to mow.
Well, you know, that's funny. That's one of the things that I tell people who ask me, what can I do to help honeybees? If they can stand it, they can raise the deck on their mower about an inch and spare all those dandelions, because they are a really great source of pollen. And my neighbors understand why I have so many in my yard. I don't think they mind.
Does the caller want to follow up?
That's it. I just wanted to, it isn't just ornamentals. It's weeds.
That's right.
Hmm. What do they think of Creeping Charlie?
You know, I'm not sure, honestly. I know that there are certain flowers that don't work for honeybees that do work for bumblebees, because some proboscis, maybe it is, are longer and shorter than others. And getting your tongue down the throat of a flower, some flowers reach and some flowers are hard to reach. So that probably affects what kinds of insects are attracted to which kind of flowers.
Mm. Interesting. And they have five eyes.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Three of them right in the middle of their head, like in a triangular pattern, are really mostly for sensing light. And the other two really large eyes that you see have tons and tons of facets on them. And depending on what kind of bee, too, also would influence the strength of their vision. The queen obviously doesn't really need to see all that well. She's going to spend most of the time inside the dark hive. But the drones, who need to be able to fly really high and spot the queen, they have amazing acuity. They have lots and lots of facets, and they can see really, really well.
Hmm. There we have to leave it. Susan, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Susan Brackney is the author of Plan B, that's B-E-E, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. And you'll find her online at www.planbbook.com. And again, B is spelled B-E-E.
And that was a program from the AM 580 archives from May 11th of this year. It's a little late for the dandelions. It was much better dandelion season back then. It is 7 minutes, 6.5 minutes, in fact, before 2 o'clock. And settlement prices for the day and the week are in. Here with those numbers, here's AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at the numbers, Tom, as they settled in Chicago on this USDA crop production and world agricultural supply demand estimate report day. Those numbers released at 7:30 a.m. We'll take them up in complete detail during the closing mark report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time today. Not very far away, but they did have an impact in Chicago. Futures were 9 cents higher in the nearby wheat contract, a 440 and a half high. The low at 425 and a quarter, with a settlement price for the soft red lead option at $4.41 and three quarters a bushel, 9 cents higher on the day. December futures, 468 and a half the high, the low at 51. Settled at 467 and a quarter, up 8.5 cents. In the March, 487 and a half the high, the low at 470 and a half. Settled at $4.87, 8.5 cents higher. May futures, $5 the high, the low at 84. Settled at $4.99 and a half, up 8.5. In July, 510 and three quarters the high, the low at 495. The harvest month, $5.10 and three quarters of a cent. Next year's wheat at 8.5 cents higher for the July contract. In Kansas City, the hard red settled 4.25 higher on the day at $4.66 and three quarters. From the corn pit in Chicago, despite a record high national average yield at what, 161.9 now, the old one at 160, and that's a big one. It was 159.5 in August, now 161.9. I think that's correct. 314.75 was the high for the day in the corn pit, the low at $3. Settlement price, despite the big move up in the national average yield, still 5 cents higher at 314.5. The trade expecting most of what was put into the marketplace by USDA today. December futures, 320.25 the high. Low at 308.75, settlement price at $3.19.75, up 4.5 cents in March, 333.5 the high, the low at 22.25. Settlement price at $3.33, up 4.25 in May futures, 342.75 the high, the low at 31.5, settlement price at 342.5, up 4.5 cents. July contract 351.5 the high, the low at 40.25. Settlement price at $3.51.25, up 4.75. And next year's December, that's the 2010 contract, 371.25 the high. The low at 59.5, settled at 370.5, up 5 cents. September oats 3/4 higher at $1.96. December at 208, up 3/4. Soy complex now. Nearby beans 11 cents higher, but the rest of the contracts were lower. Nearby is at 990 on the top, the bottom at 962.5. A settlement price for the September at $9.84.5, up 11 cents. And then came the red, $9.32 the high. The low at 897.5 in the November. Settlement price at $9.03, down 23.5. January 939.75 the high. Low at 904.25, settled 910, down 23.5 cents. And the March contract, 941.5 the high. The low at 908.5, settled 915.5, down 23.25. May futures, 941 the high. The low at $9.09.25, settled 916.25, or rather half, down 21.75. And next year's November down 11.25 at $8.99.5. Soybean meal, September contract, a 349.90 top, bottom at 36. Settlement price at $338, down $11. September soybean oil, 33.75 the high, the low at 33.30, settled at 33.36, down 34. During the closing mark report, we'll talk with Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Analytics, and Daryl Good from the U of I will be here. That all comes up in just about 9 minutes. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Quick look at the livestock portion of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange today. October live cattle finished the day unchanged, and beyond that, the table for the rest of cattle was down. Hogs were mixed. The live cattle for October had a high of 87.55 today, the low 86.95, settlement price 87.22.5 unchanged. December cattle, live cattle, 87.32.5 the high, 86.70 the low, 86.92.5 the settlement, down 22.5 on the day. February live cattle, the high 88.20, the low 87.50, settled at 87.55, down 52.5 cents. April, the high 90.12.5, the low 89.57.5, and the settlement 89.85, down 22.5. September feeder cattle had a high of 99.70, the low 99 even, settled at 99.17.5, down 32.5. October 100 even, the high, the low 99.30, the settlement 99.32.5, down 45. Feeders for November at a high of $100.60, the low 99.70, the settlement 99.75, down 60. And January, the high 101.02.5, the low for the day $100.20, the settlement price 132.5, down 62.5. Lean hogs had an update today for the October contract, the high 53.15, the low 51.80, settled 52.47.5, up 5. But the rest of the table is down. December 51.20, the high 49.40, the low 49.82.5, the settlement down 87.5. February, the high 57.45, the low 55.30, settled at 55.82.5, down 115. And April, the high 62.95, the low 61 even, settled 61.15, down 162.5. Frozen pork bellies for February, the high today 89.40, the low 87.55, settled at 88.30, up 15.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and HD3.